Welcome to Dome Theory. I'm Bobby Manning, and we're about to talk about Syracuse basketball because they made it to the Sweet 16. Surprise, surprise. The team that's on the bubble, year in and year out, just keeps making the Sweet 16. They weren't going to do it last year, and I don't want to say fortunately, but fortunately for them, that year gets erased out of the NCAA books. So we are now talking about 2019, a solid entry into March Madness for this team, even though they lost in round one. 2018, a Sweet 16 run. 2016, a Final Four run. And so that's 3 out of 5 years. This team has made the Sweet 16. What's that mean? I don't think you can take anything larger out of it. We all know the zone disrupts the right matchups in March. 2019, they did not get the right matchup. They faced a bear of a team, not to make a pun there, in Baylor that ended up becoming one of the best teams in the country within the next few years as that team started to grow into itself. And that was an 8-9 matchup at the time. So you get San Diego State, West Virginia this year, two teams that don't know how to play zone. It was an absolute disaster for those groups. Hopes that Buddy Boeheim has hit everything, and we'll get into that. One of the coolest stories in Syracuse history is Jim Boeheim's son becoming one of the best players in Syracuse history, which you think when it comes to privilege and work ethic and that kind of stuff, that the son of a legend would not have that kind of drive, specifically when he doesn't seem to have the most physically gifted tools. He's had to grind to become one of, will probably be 35 best players in Syracuse history. Maybe when it's said and done, the best shooter in Syracuse history. Him and GMAC can still have a shoot off, and I'm sure they often do. So Houston, Syracuse, Saturday at 9:55, I'm pumped. Matt Gutierrez, James Zuba, who I talk to occasionally about this team, old friend from Noon's Magician and James, and an old college friend and editor from the DO, and Matt Gutierrez, who recently had a run-in with Jim Boeheim at the end of the year and has covered this team closely for a few years now, so he's always got his hand on the pulse of this team and Syracuse and what's going on up there. I'm, of course, back in Boston, covering the Celtics, the trade deadline. I want to whip through some things before we get into our chat with James and Matt. I want to hit on the Celtics first. Evan Fournier, I don't think anyone's going crazy about it. Hurts to see Daniel Tice go. I gave my thoughts on Evan Fournier on the Garden Report podcast. I don't think I have to go too deep into that. But Daniel Tice, credit to him. He came over, I think he was a 2016 draft prospect, didn't get drafted, went back to Germany, won Defensive Player of the Year over there, comes back, sits behind Aaron Baines, Al Horford, number of others that year. When the Celtics went to the Eastern Conference Finals without him, but early in that year, he was playing some spot minutes and he was doing well, and then he ended up tearing his MCL. I believe it was at that time, so he missed the playoffs that year. Baines and Horford were obviously driving the ship at that time. 2019 comes around, has a decent year, plays a little bit more, but still stuck behind two other guys. Team collapses, Horford leaves, Irving leaves. They're left with little in the front court. Robert Williams, some potential there, but who's going to emerge and take Horford's spot? And if you look at Daniel Tice's 2020, numbers weren't all that far off from what Horford was doing for about five times as much money in the Celtics system. So he became an absolute bargain. I don't want to overrate him by any means. There was a whole thing with Bomani a few months ago of whether Tice was underrated or overrated and whether he was worth the money or a bargain for the money and all that kind of stuff. There's obviously implications of all that kind of conversation, but it just on the court terms, Daniel Tice became a fantastic sealer for this team, a great shooter by the center position standards. I think he's upper 30% from three and hit numerous big shots for this team, whether in the regular season or the postseason. Was great on their run to the Eastern Conference Finals last year, stood with Embiid, Marc Gasol, Serge Ibaka, even Bam Adebayo, gave it his best effort against him. He also came to be seen as the limitation of the center position for the Celtics, people who thought they needed more there, people who want to see higher upside, more size, and more physicality at that position, because I'm interested to see, now that Tice is a Chicago Bull, where the Celtics fans still don't think he gets a good foul. When the Celtics and Bulls meet, will Tice not be getting enough calls then? I'm interested to see that, because ultimately, I think Tice fouled a lot. I thought he got screwed occasionally on the offensive end, but he was looking for foul calls too much. And so he was going to be a free agent at the end of this year. I don't want to make this a trash him on the way out type thing, but I think it works out here. He gets to go to the Bulls. They're going to be on a playoff run. He's going to play a substantial part in that. Bulls were the winner of the trade deadline. Tice is going to get to join Nikola Vucevic, who went there in a fantastic deal for both sides, I think. He's going to join Zach LaVine, one of the 15 best players in the NBA this year. Patrick Williams, who's going to go down as one of the best five players picked in the last year's draft. And he'll be the backup center, Tice, that is, in that whole situation that they have there in Chicago that is looking more and more like a playoff situation. They have tons of potential as a team. They have a nice coach in Billy Donovan. So credit to Chicago, who finally, for the first time since Derrick Rose, I think have something to be excited about. Nuggets were a good landing spot for Aaron Gordon. I think he's going to get a ton of catch-and-shoot threes, which he's 44% on this year. He's going to be a defensive menace. I saw NBC said he's top 15 in holding opponents to low field goal percentage. He's at one of the 15 lowest in one-on-one matchups. So now his time. He can't be inconsistent now. He doesn't have that first option excuse on Denver. So he ends up moving. Powell goes to Portland. Don't know how it's going to impact their defense, which is their biggest problem, of course, but they get even more firepower. Probably the best shooting team in basketball right now. They have good center play between Nurkic and Kanter. I don't want to see them out west if I'm a playoff team. Certainly not the Lakers, who are banged up right now. That would be a fun rematch from last year where Portland took one, was competitive, but slid as the series went on. So that was the gist of your trade deadline. Nothing insane. Vucevic was surprising. Kyle Lowry doesn't move. Oladipo goes to Miami. I don't think that's going to shift the power in the East all that much. We'll see if he's able to get above 31% on pull-up jumpers, 33%, I believe, from three, and below 40% from the field. He has struggled mightily, and if you look at his numbers, it's been a few years since Victor Oladipo has been effective on a basketball court. So they're banking on him consolidating the contributions of Kelly Olynyk, Avery Bradley. Don't think that will be too difficult to do, but is there upside there beyond that? That's the question they're asking in Miami. And Houston, good luck. I mean, they're probably going to get the number one, number two pick, but man, what do they have to show around it? Ultimately, the James Harden deal nets you some first-round picks from Brooklyn. We'll see how those go. Avery Bradley and Kelly Olynyk. So the question I ask as we get into our interview here, could the Celtics have made that deal? Avery Bradley, Kelly Olynyk. I think I'm faxing that one in on trade deadline 2017. Yeah. I think I would have done that at the time. Amazing how that's how it all ended up working out here. Credit to the Cavaliers. Credit to the Heat, who have, and even the Pacers, who have stolen talent off Houston's stupidity at this point. And bless my friend Nima, who continues to root for that team. Maybe some things will break their way, but I don't see brightness when it comes to the decision makers there in Houston. They are the losers of this trade deadline. All right, so appreciate you guys. Subscribe to the Bobcast newsletter and the YouTube channel as well, where we'll hopefully do some more video work now that all the trade stuff's done. Celtics Blog, CLNS Media, and Boston Sports Journal is where you can read me. I'm Bobby Manning. This is Dome Theory. Subscribe, Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher. And here is Matt Gutierrez, James Zuber, as we get ready for Syracuse at the bracket. My bracket's number one as we handle this Sweet 16. Can it stay there? Can I get this $1,000? Can I add to my stimulus total here? Or am I just going to keep losing when it comes to the sports pick stuff, as I'll call it? Hope you're doing well with that out there. Hope to hear from you guys what you want to hear on this show, what you want to see interview-wise. I'm open to a lot of different stuff. As I said, we got some documentary-style stuff coming as well as things lighten up here a little bit into April. And then 23 next week. That's me. 23. Can you believe it? All right, I'm going to stop yawning, and I'm going to get into this interview with James Zuba and Mac Gutierrez on Dome Theory. Did Matthew Gutierrez do a bracket?
I did. I did a woman's bracket as well.
Wow. Which one's Stanford. Doing better?
Women's. And I've watched way less women's, but that's how the brackets work. The more you watch, generally, the worse you do.
So true.
As James knows, James is good with college hoops, and you know, he might be doing well. I don't know, but sometimes I feel like people who know the game don't do well.
No, so true. Some of my brackets are okay, but other ones are just like totally trash. Like the Midwest region is totally trash. Like I had Illinois going really far, and who else did? Oh, and I had West Virginia in my other brackets too. So it's like that whole side of the bracket is screwed for me.
So yeah. I don't want to get overconfident because this could all turn into a disaster in a week. But I'm looking pretty good right now. I had Ohio over Virginia because everyone kept telling me Ohio was looking pretty good.
Nice.
I had Syracuse going two rounds just because.
There you go. Looked
like a genius.
And Alabama's made a little run here. Florida State's made a little run. So, and then, you know, picking Gonzaga to win wasn't all that bold, but it's a pretty straight shot. So I'm in the 98th percentile right now.
Woo!
And first in my group. Which has $1,000 on the line. So
wow,
that would be a nice way to start the year.
There you go.
Now, I was gonna say, you know, you have to go to a Celtics game, but we don't want to get ahead of ourselves with that money yet. Spending. If you want to save, Celtics game.
So the Garden just let fans in for the first time tonight. So it's possible
nice. Now, what are they doing? Like 20%.
10%. Yeah, 2,100, I think, they're letting in.
Okay.
So it's pretty much the same as MSG, Barclays, what they're doing in New York. But they did it like a month later. So I'm excited for that because the Celtics will be back the 29th. And you actually do notice going from 0 to 2,000. When the Knicks let fans in, and that was a different feeling because the Knicks are on their 500 run, glory run this year to the 8 seed. The fans were going nuts, all 2,000 that they let in, and it was a real atmosphere, even though they ended up losing that game. So I'm excited. The Dome waited like an extra game. They didn't want to – it feels like they didn't want to let fans in for that last game of the year. I think it was UNC, and then like lacrosse fans were there the next day. There was like 900. So
it's a New York State thing, man.
Yeah.
You know, New York State makes the Catholic Church look nimble. It's amazing. But
in the state, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's not a Syracuse University thing. I mean, unless you know any different, like unless the university was just like lagging in their plan to get fans in the door, which is honestly quite possible. But no, it was a New York State thing. I mean, they were kind of slow to act on that.
All right, so. We hit on our brackets. We hit on fans. Now we're going to come and talk about what we came here to talk about. Syracuse in the Sweet 16 again. What is this, 3 times in 5 seasons, right? Going back to 2016, you can exclude. Excluding last year is the best thing that ever happened to Jim Boeheim and Syracuse because they can just completely eliminate a year where they wouldn't have made March period and it probably would have been one of the worst seasons of his tenure at Syracuse. But they can just scratch that off. They ended with a win. They went undefeated in the ACC tournament, and then they carried it right into this year where they had their ups, they had their downs. I'd say around late January, I gave up on this team. I thought when they lost by, 30 at Pittsburgh, that was rock bottom for me, and I said, this team just doesn't have it. And here they are, win a 16 left standing. I'm with James Zuba, my former colleague at noonsmagician.com, and Matt Gutierrez, who covers Syracuse for The Athletic. As 5'6", 5'5", I don't know. Something in there, right?
Something in there. I'm undersized PG, but under 6 foot.
Here's what I'll say to Jim Boeheim. One of the great figures in sports history, Fife Dog, you know, never played sports, but popularized sports jerseys, sports references, and rap. 5 feet. I mean, he didn't have to. If you're asking people who Jim Boeheim is and you're asking people who Fife Dog is, I think more people know who Faith Dog is, and he was 5 foot, the 5-footer. So doesn't matter how tall you are. Matt's actually not that short. I think Jim was wrong with that when he did that, but we're not going to labor on that. Syracuse, Sweet 16. How stunning was this for you, Matt?
Yeah, I'm interested in James' take. Obviously, he's seen the program for longer than I have, but just based on what I've seen from the past few years, I mean, I'm shocked. I was among the many people who basically wrote this team off, to your point, Bobby, right around the Pittsburgh game, Clemson blowout, just because we've seen Q's teams sneak in before, right, and make runs for sure. But those teams generally never really got blown out, right? They were never out of games like that. There might be one or two anomalies, but they were always in games. They were competitive, and mostly because of the zone, right? The zone in those seasons, 2016 and 18, notably, was really solid. I think the 16 team was top 50, top 40 zone, and the 2018 zone was a top 5 defense in the country. So you always had that to rely on. This year, you didn't have the zone. It was floating in the 80s and 90s for most of the year, and here they are still. After giving up all those point totals, flipping the script, really dialing in defensively. The numbers don't really show it, but even just a couple of rotations that they weren't making earlier in the year now makes a big difference. And then obviously the shooting has been on fire. And so I think those are not to overthink it. I think that's simply where we're at right now.
That's what blows my mind, James. I didn't see any potential for the zone because I obviously covered Girard and Boeheim last year. They didn't look like they had much defensive potential to me, and the top of that zone matters. And they, of course, were missing Sidibe. Edwards didn't play a lot underneath this year, so it was just a Dolezal thing that they've been doing on and off for 3 years now. And then, you know, Alan Griffin, probably not as good as Elijah Hughes, a solid defender in there, so you figured that would be a net neutral, and they were a bad defense last year. So I didn't see any upside for this defense whatsoever, but whether it's mixing in Kadari Richmond, whether it's mixing in a little Jesse Edwards later in the year, they've legitimately, as recently as this West Virginia game, look outstanding on that end. Like, would they give up 18 in the first half of that game? Like, it just blew my mind. Or that was San Diego State that they gave up 18 in the first half. It blows my mind what they've done these last two games defensively. It looks like that 2018, you know, maybe not that great, but something closer to that group that was just rock solid in the March.
Yeah, night and day. You know, it's funny how quickly the narrative changes. I mean, when you look back to some of those losses in January and February, you know, the conversation is now is, well, Jim Boeheim has proved all the naysayers wrong and, you know, this, that, and the third. Well, I think the naysayers had a pretty good reason to be naysayers back in January with those losses to Pittsburgh, you know, losses to Clemson, lost by 20 at Georgia Tech, at Duke. So there was a lot of reason to be critical of the program. But, yeah, I mean, certainly they've turned it around. A lot has changed. A lot has changed since then. You know, Alan Griffin, you mentioned he's a first-year guy, so he's just learning the zone for the first time. But you started to see Robert Braswell get some more reps. You know, Jim Boeheim is very complimentary of him with the zone, says he's a better defender than Alan, a little bit longer. He knows the rotations a little bit better. Jesse's worked in. He's last game against West Virginia was a little bit shaky, but he started to look a little bit more comfortable. And Kadari Richmond played more. You know, I think we all know that Kadari is one of the better defenders, at least in terms of raw athleticism within the zone, you know, getting his hands on balls, getting in passing lanes, so on and so forth. So he's played more, he's improved. And you know, frankly, Bob Boeheim and Joe Girard have gotten better as the season has gone on. So, you know, the defense is much improved. I don't think it's as good as it was in 2018, but certainly they've made some major strides this season, and they're clicking on all cylinders right now.
Now Matt, where'd Buddy play high school?
What position or what?
High school?
I did at JD and then at Brewster.
And where did Kadari play?
He played at South Shore High School in Brooklyn and then Brewster for
Did they overlap? No, he was only there 1 year then, so they didn't overlap at all. All right, because I was wondering if there was like any past chemistry there or something, because you know when they play together and they look pretty decent together in that zone, besides that breakdown late against Virginia in that ACC tournament. But I've been blown away by Kadari. I think that underrated moment of the West Virginia win was when Buddy was just getting face guard on the left side there. He had scored like 20 points in each of those last four games. They can't get the ball to him late, and Kadari just pulls up for that too. And then obviously Syracuse let West Virginia within two. So I thought that was the moment of that game that he was just able to pull up and grab a jumper right there. He's assertive offensively, but his defense is just otherworldly, at least by the ACC standards.
Yeah, I mean, he's got the length, the 6'10 wingspan. He's got the instincts.
6'10, really? Wow.
Yeah, for a 6'5 guard. I mean, he's a good athlete. Obviously, you know, he's prone to some mistakes and he's missed some rotations for sure and hasn't gotten out the shooters every time at all. He's not a perfect player. He's turned the ball over. But you look at his numbers and in about 20 minutes a game, he's really done a nice job for Cuse, especially of late. And as Boeheim has said, he's kind of like a Dolezal where he's not going to show everything he does in the stat sheet, but just the hockey assists, the regular assists, the spatial awareness of where guys need to be. One thing about this offense, it's a top 25 offense for the second straight year, and they don't call a lot of set plays. They really don't have a traditional five man for a pick and roll, and they still score a lot of points against elite defenses. Just take these last two games, top 15 defenses. Cuse is putting up, I think, 75 and 78 points. And it's just a credit to their spacing and their ball movement and guys like Marek and Kadari who really just kind of do the little things that make everything go. Of course, you know, Buddy's shooting performance pads the numbers a little bit, but you know, this is a team that I think just really gels together. And to your point, Kadari's a special player. He's such a good slasher, and we've seen some glimpses of the jump shots lately. I mean, if he's going to hit that 3-point shot or even that 17 footer, watch out for him, you know, either down the stretch here or next season for sure.
And this is really Buddy shooting them to new heights with the offensive feats that he's pulled off here. But I always do like digging deeper on some of the other guys that are involved in this, because this really has been a team just stepping up to a new level across the board. Maybe Alan Griffin, you exclude a little bit from that. Something weird's going on with him where he hasn't been able to contribute all that much over the last few games. But I want to throw Robert Braswell at you, James, because if I'm ever drawing parallels between the Celtics and Syracuse, and I always do, there's a Robert on both teams that when they're playing through the roof, and Robert Williams, of course, is the guy with the Celtics, the team has a new ceiling. I never saw one for Robert Braswell, though. We always hyped him up, but we never knew if there was actually potential there. And then he comes out and hits a ginormous shot down the stretch against West Virginia, but also has just played good basketball the entire postseason for this team, second half of the year. It felt like he's the first guy off the Syracuse bench many nights, and he's a real contributing force for this team and maybe a piece for a few more years here at Syracuse. It's unbelievable what he's been able to do down the stretch of the season, because he was ready to transfer from Syracuse at the end of last year, and he looked lost in the shuffle at the beginning of this year.
Yeah, he's been a factor, and he's carved out a role. Early in the season, as you mentioned, he started off 0 from 12 from 3. Just didn't really look confident. Didn't really look like he had enough reps in. Maybe some of the pauses had something to do with that, especially because he's a shooter, at least on the offensive end. But I think by and large, for the most part, defensively, he's been good. Syracuse could kind of rely on him defensively, and I think that's kind of why he kind of won out that back, you know, backup forward role. But offensively, he's come along. I mean, he's taken another step forward. He looks a lot more confident. He's stepping into his shots with rhythm. You know, he's starting to make some reads too. You know, against San Diego State, he sets the screen and then, you know, two kind of go with Buddy and he's open and he's all of a sudden he's getting a dunk at the rim. So he's starting to look a little bit more comfortable out there. But yeah, he's stepped up big time. And you know, I like that you said that. Obviously, Buddy's getting all the headlines, and you know, rightfully so. The way that he's shooting the ball, he's been incredible, and he's taken it to another level. But some of these other guys, really, with the exception of Griffin, have played well. Marek, you know, Gerard stepped up his play. Kadari's played an important role. You know, and the same with Quincy Guerrier as well. So a lot of these other guys have stepped up in March. That's for sure.
Yeah, and we do have a lot of headlines here today. Matt pointed this out earlier: New York Times, Buddy Boeheim, Zagoria. New York Post, Buddy Boeheim, Julie Boeheim, ads, of course, Washington Post, Buddy Boeheim thought he'd just be a role player. Now he's Syracuse's leading man. I said this last year when I was covering this team, there's Dane O'Neill, Athletic. This is really the fact that you, and we've seen like great coaches' sons be on teams. I think like Coach Cal's son was on a team, or Michigan State there had a son on a team. To have Jim Boeheim's son like not only just walk on Syracuse's program or just be on the team, it happens all the time, but for him to actually become like the lead scorer, centerpiece player on a program, scoring upwards of 30 points a game, leading a March Madness push, that's got to be, and there's been so many great Jim Boeheim stories over the years, but this has got to be right up there in the top 3 to 5. And I said that last year before this even rose to another level where he's carrying this team this year. And that like pull up from half court against San Diego State nearly was like a moment that you're going to remember forever with this team, where he was just pushing it to new heights throughout that game. The first half against West Virginia was a little slower, but then he comes out and seals it in that second half. He's getting real heavy coverage, traps, all that stuff, and he's still getting it done. He's putting it on the floor a little bit more, but really the shot, like upwards of 60% from three at this point. The NBA scouts are taking notice, several people have said. This was just unimaginable for him. I think when we were tracking him coming in, James, he was what, like a top 150 recruit, maybe? Like, well, not a ton of serious offers there. So the fact that it's come to this is, as all these stories have outlined here, just unimaginable. How did this happen, Matt?
Hey, we throw around the term hard work quite a bit in life and in sports, and you work hard. James works hard and wakes up way before me every day. That said, Buddy is in a category of his own as far as college basketball workers. I mean, the kid, this is not an accident. I mean, he works so hard. This is someone who's not, you know, all that athletic as like just like born relative to high major Division I players. And I think Buddy and Jim would be the first to tell you that. He is someone who has worked his way to this stardom by taking shot after shot after shot since he was a kid, but really revving it up the past couple of years, right? With the 4 hours a day in the off season, the workouts in his home gym, the three a day workouts, the weightlifting, he's put on some weight. I was just looking at some clips from him from high school and even his freshman year, how much thinner he was, just kind of in the arms and shoulders. And he's put on, I guess lean shooter's muscle, if you will. Yeah. Like he's not too bulky.
Him and Gerard both came into this year looking much bigger.
Yeah, for sure. And I think Buddy's just toned and has really owned in on that. He's got the high release and he's creating for his own a little bit. Obviously he's more of a shooter than anything else, but he is creating a little bit off the bounce too.
So quick too, that release. It came off his hand so quickly against West Virginia. I was just like, what is this? Like, is this Curry here? Like, what is going on? And everything he puts up, it was just going down. And you're watching this, it's just like, oh my Lord. I really don't remember my full expectations of him coming in, James. Like, I guess I just figured that first year he'd be a nice piece off the bench. You knew he could shoot. But what was your, like, first impression of him coming in? And what did you ultimately expect his career to be at Syracuse versus what it became?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, we look back on the recruiting rankings and say, oh, Buddy was a sub 200 player. Well, there was good reason for that. You know, I mean, players get better, and that's a testament to his work ethic and the time that he's put in. And he really has. He's really improved. But no, initially coming in, I mean, I thought he could be successful. I didn't think he was going to play much his freshman year. Certainly when you think back to that backcourt, they had Frank Howard, Tyus Battle, and then a top 50 recruit coming in, Jalen Carey, in that same freshman class. But they needed a shooter. He played a little bit his freshman year. He played okay. And then his sophomore year, he really took off too. I mean, he had a really good year last year, kind of in that, Robin Hood role, if you would call it, right next to Elijah Hughes. Elijah led the team in scoring, but Buddy was kind of that secondary scorer. And he led the Power Five in makes from three-point land. So he had a pretty good sophomore year. I think people forget that. But, certainly this year he's put in the work. Struggled out of the gate, tested positive for COVID back in December, as we know. Took him a little bit longer to get his legs back underneath him, but he really turned it around in February, started shooting the ball well, and then in March he just evolved into something completely different. I mean, it's kind of unbelievable just the way that he shot the ball. It's been another level.
Yeah, and I think when I did the numbers out based off his regular season scoring this year, and this is the end of his junior year, who knows if he's going to stay 5 years or could he stay 3 years? Who knows at this point? It looks like he'll probably be a top 35 scorer in Syracuse history, I think is what he's on track for by the end of it. So he's really going to go down legitimately as one of the best players in the program's history, which is unimaginable. But Jim still holds out that he was better, Matt, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, he half jokingly, I don't know how serious he is. You never know with Jim. Like, sometimes he's being sarcastic. Sometimes he's got a little, he's throwing a little shade in there. You know, as you guys both know, right? You kind of, you're not always sure of the tone. But yeah, he said Buddy's the better shooter, but Jim still thinks he's got him. This is when they're both 20, right? So with Jim at 20, Buddy at 20, even age, relatively even athleticism. I don't know. I'm taking Buddy every day of the week, but.
I guess I got to look at some gym clips.
I'm taking Buddy to that. Hey, you know, it all depends on how much, you know, how much longer he stays at Syracuse, but he's got a legitimate shot to break Jerry's record of 400 made threes if he stays two more years. And he's got a really good chance to be number two. Andy Routon sits second all time with 282 makes. So Buddy's got a legitimate shot to break that.
Is he already third?
He's fifth right now. He just passed Devendorf.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing about basketball in general now is if you're a great shooter, you have the amount of attempts where the game is now. We pretty much anybody can break a record. I think Marcus Smart's probably going to become the all-time Celtics three-point shooter over – I don't even know who the all-time is, but he's well on track for it at this point. And so Buddy Boeheim could end up being the all-time Syracuse shooter there. I do want to throw some love to Quincy Guerrier as well, who's been solid in this tournament and had an outstanding year, which I think is what gets overlooked a lot of the time, the guys who really that foundation even getting in the tournament in the first place. And he laid such a good groundwork for this team this year. Obviously, he was hurt last year, we found out after, and he was so out of it last year that it had to be something like that because it was just a disastrous freshman year all around for him, which was a big reason the team didn't meet its potential last year. And now you see the guy who I think Jeff Goodman had at the end of last year is like a top 10 NBA draft pick. I don't know if he's going to have that sort of potential after meeting his expectations this year, but at the very least, he's made Syracuse a really good team this year, and he's been exciting to watch, strong on the boards, double-double guy at times this year. They'll probably need a little bit more from him if they're going to beat Houston here, and I guess we'll start transitioning a little bit to what needs to happen for that to occur. I don't know a ton about Houston. I just know they're really good, and they just pulled off an unimaginable comeback to even get to this point where they almost lost to Rutgers, which who knows if that actually would have been better for Syracuse because Rutgers beat Syracuse. But Quincy Guerrier, what's been different for them this year? The shooting really hasn't all been all that much better, but he's just getting inside and powering to the rim, James.
Yeah, he started off the year really strong. You know, he came out and he had a lot of double-doubles to start the season. He's really cooled off in the past month, but he did have a strong showing against West Virginia. You know, he had five blocks in that game as well. I think that was an overlooked aspect of his game. But, yeah, you know, you heard Jim Boeheim say it after the game, and I think he's kind of right on with this, is that Quincy's right there, and he's just on the verge of really impacting and putting his footprint all over the game. And this Houston game is the kind of game where he could really shine. You know, Houston, you know, one of their point guards, he's the AAC Defensive Player of the Year. He had a hit pointer in the opening round game. Would expect him to guard Buddy Boeheim. But, you know, the guards on Houston, they really get up and they create a lot of pressure. They play really good defense. This could be a really physical game, and that's the kind of game where Quincy could really play an important role. He stepped out. He's been able to shoot. He shoot it better this year from the three. But I think he's really better when he can get the ball inside and kind of work and get on the glass. Houston, we know – you know, they're one of the best offensive rebounding teams in the country. So rebounding is going to be really important out of the zone. This has Quincy written all over it. So if Syracuse is going to win this game, they're going to need him.
A pretty good rebounding team this year too, Syracuse, haven't they been? So that's been a plus. No?
Defensively, not as good. You know,
offensively is where they're getting it, yeah.
Yeah, but Quincy can get on the offensive glass. Yeah, Quincy can get on the offensive glass and impact the game that way as well.
So they met expectations, Matt, at this point, and we can kind of belabor over whether a great postseason run makes up for some of these close calls on Selection Sunday and the deficiencies we've seen during the regular season, the inability to compete in the ACC. But ultimately, as a fan, you probably take this 10 times out of 10. The great playoff run, the notoriety in March, the publicity you get out of all of that. Like, you don't want to be Virginia this year losing round one after a pretty solid season, so yeah, you'll take this always. But does this have a chance to extend anymore, you think, looking ahead to Houston on Saturday?
Yeah, it does. And to echo James's point, that's a great, you know, great thought on Quincy's role here. Houston, I think, leads the country or is second in offensive rebounding. And they're going to crash the glass. I watched some clips from their game. You know, they're 26 or 27 and three. They crashed three guys minimum every single shot. And Kelvin Sampson, their coach, basically the mentality is, you know, if we're going to miss a shot against the zone, no problem. We're looking for those second and third chances. And Cuse is a little bit vulnerable there. West Virginia did have 18 offensive boards on Sunday, and that's even in a game where Cuse had its best, one of its best defensive halves, at least, I think the first half in the whole season. So something to keep an eye on there. But, you know, to James's point, Houston is, you know, his tallest player is 6'8". They're not going to blow you away with size. They're more going to get to you with mentality and athleticism and speed. This is a game where Quincy could take advantage of some mismatches. I could see him kind of in the post. Houston has a thing where they basically double everything in the post. So Quincy's going to, you know, he's a smart player. He's just going to need to use that IQ that he has and, you know, read what if he needs to do a skip pass or can he wait out the double so it becomes just a one-on-one. That'll be really interesting. But to what you guys said there, I just pulled up Quincy's stats. He's up from 6.9 points a game to 13.9 and from 5.3 rebounds to 8.5 rebounds. He's up from 20 minutes a game to about 33 minutes a game. And as James said, from 12.5% from three, pretty bad last year, to 31% from three now. So
yeah,
he's a respectable 3-point shooter. I think he had two against West Virginia. I think he was 2 for 3. So he's expanded his game. You know, looking ahead, I don't know if he's going to enter the draft or not. He will be 22 years old, which is old for a college sophomore soon. So that's something that might play a role in his decision. But if he does stay next year, I agree with Jim Boeheim. I think he could be an All-American caliber player if he has that next step. And he works really hard. So it's not like he's not putting in the work and the time to get really good.
And I saw Jim on First Take this morning to throw even more publicity out there for, I guess it just all hit on the same day ahead of this weekend for him, a couple of days in between. Do you think he would take a look at what's out there after this? If just to, you know, see, I don't know if he had these draft rumblings or his ability to jump to that next level is real or what, but do you think he would even just explore it? Cause you can do that now as a college player, you can just jump in, do the combine, all that stuff. It's a better situation this year probably than what Elijah was jumping into last year, but there was just nothing. So he probably just has to go see what's out there for him after this, if this keeps rolling, right?
It's interesting. You know, he was asked this yesterday in the post, well, in the Zoom, and, you know, maybe I'm being naive, maybe I'm being charmed here, but he struck me as very, very surprised by all this. You know, the NBA attention, he said, that's crazy to me. You know, I never imagined I'd be in this position. And, you know, obviously he spoke glowingly of Syracuse and his dad being there and growing up and going to games and all that. So, but at the same time, if you're getting NBA looks and you're getting NBA attention, it's really interesting. I think it's something that you would have to take a look at just objectively if you're Buddy and you have an opportunity to play at the next level. But there is a part of me that says he's a Syracuse kid. He's got a unique opportunity to play for his dad toward the end of his dad's career. You don't really get an opportunity like this. You're not going to certainly not going to get it again. And the NBA is going to be there. So I do tend to lean toward, you know, Buddy comes back to Syracuse and finishes out his career, but you never know. And of course, certainly no one's going to tell you right now that they're thinking about it or they're going to go to the NBA at this point when you have a Sweet 16 matchup coming up. So it's all very fascinating. I'll say that.
Is this one winnable from your perspective? I mean, of course it probably is, but can you envision them winning this next round here against Houston?
They could. It's going to be a tough matchup. I think a lot depends on Giroux, Houston's guard there. He plays really good defense. He suffered a hip pointer, as I said. So a lot's going to depend on how healthy he is. He did play against Rutgers, and he looked really good in that game. You know, Quentin Grimes is the Kansas transfer. He puts up, I believe, 18 a game, so he's tough. But I would lean Houston right now. I think they're the better team. I think the offensive rebounding is going to be a problem for Syracuse. I think they're going to get on the glass. And I think they're going to pressure them defensively. I think it might be a game where we might see more of Kadari Richmond. But, you know, certainly they can win it if they come out and they shoot the ball well. And Quincy plays strong inside, and you get those bench contributions, the zone tightens up. Yeah, it's certainly a game they could win, but right now I would lean towards Houston.
It's amazing how this region has developed at this point. I loved Oklahoma State. I think I just fall in love with those top prospects coming in, and they fizzled out against Oregon State, who, if you look at them, they're now three games into a ridiculous run. Well, even more than that, they've had to win a couple to come out of the Pac-12, and what the Pac-12's done in this entire tournament has been ridiculous. But them in particular, beating Tennessee, beating Oklahoma State, and now really having a pretty solid chance here. I know Loyola Chicago is a really good team, but that game could go either way and they land in the Elite Eight. So that's just absurd to me. Illinois drops here. That was a popular champion pick for a lot of people due to Kofi Cockburn and everything else that they're doing there. They just got destroyed in that game, which blew my mind. And then, of course, what Syracuse is doing out here. So this region, and it's not going to be easy by any means, but there's a path here to that Final Four.
Yeah, for sure. And even the national champ, I mean, I'm not putting anything past them. If they're going to shoot 50% from three, then, I mean, they're going to be in any game virtually. Even, I might sound dumb later and kick myself for this, but even in a game like in a Gonzaga game, let's just get ahead of ourselves, whatever, we're just talking. Cuse Gonzaga title game. If
Matt Cuse has taken it all the way.
I'm serious. If Cuse is going to shoot 60% from three, they're going to be in the game. I'm not saying they're going to beat Gonzaga. There's so many weapons on a team.
All right, 0-3 in 2021, baby.
Hey, I'm not going to go
Carmelo and Buddy.
That far, but you never know, man. But for sure, I mean, this is capable of the Final Four. I think if they can get it past Houston, obviously. Loyola Chicago likely would be the next matchup, and they are an elite defense again. But hey, again, if you're making these shots, Buddy's getting his mismatches. It's incredible. And so, you know, this one is thing where, you said earlier.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I just wanted to add, and to both of you guys know this, I think only two other programs have made the Sweet 16. Two or three other programs have made the Sweet 16 more than Syracuse in the last, I think, decade or 12 years, which is incredible given. They've been an average team in the ACC regular season for 6 years. It's just such an interesting dynamic. And in college basketball, I mean, the March results are really what matters most. I still think the regular season does matter. It's just a really interesting dynamic. You know, I give credit to Syracuse. They really get it done in these final weeks.
I got to imagine this would probably be, if Oregon State and Syracuse won, the first like 11-12 and below matchup in an Elite Eight. That's like, that just off the top of my head has to be the first time that would ever happen. Maybe that happened at some point in the past, but again, it's a weird region. It's been a weird tournament as a whole so far. You have a game not being played between Oregon and VCU, just upsets everywhere. You know, weird product, weird games, but it's all been entertaining. So you take it from a Syracuse standpoint and you take it as a college fan. I think a lot of people didn't know college was even going on this year. And then once this happened, they all bought in. People got interested again. We talked in the beginning of the season. I was skeptical, certainly, of how the season was going to go. And there were a million bumps along the way. There were issues in the conference tournament. There's been one issue now in this tournament. It's still not over yet, so we'll see if they can get to the finish line of this thing. But I think college basketball has gotten further than I expected them to, and it's been a good product so far, so I give them credit for that. A few other things I want to hit on with you guys. Zoom clock's running in, so we'll take a quick break here. But when we get back, I do want to talk about that VCU-Oregon situation, as well as the women's tournament with Matt touched on as well, and the Syracuse women. Just finishing up their season as well. So we'll hit on that real quick when we get back, and see you on the other side. Let me put this on the record on Boeheim, and you guys can take it where you want from here. No matter what you think about the high moments with him vocally and the low moments with him vocally and the low blows or whatever, I do think the one thing you have to give him credit for this time of year is that vocal advocacy for the team and the respect he has around the college circles and stuff, because every time it comes down to this team being on the bubble, you hear every single day from him, yeah, we're in. And like the announcers are repeating it, and the people around the league are saying like, oh yeah, the Syracuse, they're in. And the system's so convoluted, whether it be like the net rankings or what wins better than another win or what team on the bubble is above another team, that I really think, and this is just me guessing here, maybe Matt, you have like a more research view on this, that Boeheim advocating every single day that the team's obviously in, and it hasn't always worked. It didn't work in 17 and probably wouldn't have worked last year, but this year in particular, when it seemed like this team was going to be a first four team, maybe not in at all, it seemed to help at the very least that he's out there every day, so well connected and has such a platform that he can just throw out this notion that they're obviously in and they have a resume that's perfect and everything else, and all of a sudden they have the 11th seed and don't even have to do a play-in tournament. That's kind of what struck me about the weeks coming into this tournament.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely, you know, will certainly use, I don't have the context, it seems like he does use the press conference late in the year more than other coaches to sort of advocate for being off the bubble. I could be wrong on that. It just seems that way. Part of that might be because he's a Hall of Fame coach and he has a lot of reach and what he says, and maybe other bubble teams don't have a Hall of Fame coach who have that much reach. It just seems apparent for sure that he does make that argument. Does it help them get in the dance? You know, we'll never know for sure. It might. I think, you know, one thing that certainly helps or plays a little bit of a role at least is we even just saw the Sunday ratings. I mean, the Cuse West Virginia game was the most watched game so far of the tournament. And Cuse has a big draw. There's a huge alumni network. There's a lot of fans. It's a national school. It's not a, you know, it's not an upstate New York private, small private school. It's literally a national school and it's got a brand. So I think that, you know, that might help. But that said, I mean, Cuse did deserve to get in. They played hot of late down the stretch. And, you know, they're aside from the Q1 record, I mean, they were really stellar. They took care of business pretty much, doing everything they needed to do except beat, you know, those top teams away from the Carrier Dome.
So there was a laundry list of comments from Boeheim this year, Jim, James, and you mentioned before we got on here that you summed them up. Talked about his most recent quotes from the end of the year, him taking criticism, and we seem to have quite a bit of evidence from the end of the year that you don't even have to go back that far to test that theory of whether or not he can take criticism or whether he's above it and all that. I think the one that stuck out the most was the lunchtime players for Gerard and Boeheim. Again, you mentioned it before we got on here, that seemed to be taken out of context, but that's just what he does. He spins it, he makes it motivation for himself and the team, and he just can't seem to help himself sometimes when it comes to that stuff.
Sure. Yeah, in fairness, if you're just seeing a tweet, and you know, we could all do this based on, you know, people throwing up graphics and tweets and stuff all the time, you know, it's easy for things to get taken out of context, but you know, that's fair game. If you see something out there and it's criticizing your players or something along those lines, if you want to put that back in somebody's face after they play well, by all means, that's fair game. So some of the other stuff is just unnecessary or just, you know, throwing digs when you know, things have been water under the bridge, and you know, at that point, it's just probably better to move on. So I mean, you know, Boeheim's going to do this. It doesn't really matter what anybody says. This is just how he is. It's just what he's going to do. But that's how he is. But you know, the idea that he doesn't, you know, hear criticism or it doesn't bother him, I think there's a long list of instances in which we know that it is. And frankly, that's why people like him. I mean, people don't like certain Hall of Fame coaches because they act like robots or they act like they don't concern themselves with opinions that come from outside their team. People like Boeheim because he's human. So I just think that's one aspect of him that, you know, he shouldn't really necessarily hide. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that he doesn't, you know, like criticism.
Yeah.
Or doesn't pretend not to like criticism.
Yeah. One thing, can I add one thing in there real quick, Bobby?
Please.
To James's point, I mean, look, you know, I'm now on the long list of reporters who have been, you know, quote unquote berated, whatever we want to call it. If you think I deserved it,
isn't it amazing? You step in the room and there's a moment like no one can step into that press conference room for any like a significant amount of time, let's say a season, and not have some sort of story on that front. It's unreal.
Yeah, It is. It is. I can't tell you how many people email me, you know, DO reporters from the 80s. Like, I had the same thing. National reporters, welcome to the club, whatever. And, you know, the next day, the next week, you know, hopefully next month, whatever it is, he's usually going to just talk to you like normal again. You know, that's the thing. And to James's point, I would, even if he wants to like get upset with me about something I tweet or write, like, that's fair game. I don't even really care. I don't take it personal. I don't really care. I mean, I appreciate how honest he is. Like, he tells us so much stuff after games. And does he throw his players under the bus sometimes? You could probably make the argument he does, and other coaches won't, but he is so honest. And that's what we want, right? So I'll take that over a dry coach who's going to tell me, you know, just a couple boring scripted lines every press conference any day of the week, even if it means some of us get some heat. Like, you know what? That's fine, really. It really is.
And I don't know exactly where it came from or the context of what, but lunchtime player just seems to be like such a dig that like fits into his era, like growing up and going to the Y and seeing those guys, and the, like, that just seems like such like a 1970s 1980s like perfect gym day practice. Like, if I was gonna diss someone's game now, I don't think I'd be calling them a lunchtime player. I don't know, but again, that was probably meant as a compliment, right, Matt?
Yeah, no, it was. Again, it didn't come across that way. I understand how it didn't. You know, I even Seth tweeted out it was meant to be, you know, a compliment by that coach, and it's fine. Again, if they want to use that as motivation, by all means. These are volume guys, right? They were shooting 30%. I think, to what James said earlier, this is a team that, you know, we can talk about how Cuse, you know, all the haters early. I mean, it was deserved criticism. The team was not playing to the program expectations. And there's going to be criticism. There are going to be questions asked, you know, why isn't someone else playing? You know, why is the zone not what the zone usually is? And it's not so much like we're trying to attack anyone. It's genuine questions, number one. But number two, it speaks to how good this program is. Like, this is the sixth winningest program in college hoops. If it's not, if they're not meeting that bar or close to it, they're going to get questions because there is a high bar. So it's almost a, in that sense, can become come across as a compliment to what they're capable of and what the norm is here, if that makes sense.
For sure. So what stuck out to you guys otherwise about March? I guess I'll start off with the VCU Oregon thing. It was what it was ultimately. That's how the NCAA said they were going to handle this. Feels weird that Oregon got to go into round two without playing a game before, and who knows if that spilled over them destroying Iowa in that next one. But I was surprised that the fill-in team or whatever that was, like, was it too late for that? Was it too late for Louisville to step in and play that game? Or, like, it just felt like it was handled weird. I guess it was so last minute that they just had to send them on, but that was kind of an early mark on the tournament.
Yeah, as far as the replacement teams go, there was a deadline. Yeah. So I think it was beyond that Thursday. If they hadn't been notified by Thursday that they weren't going to get in regardless of what happened. So that's what you saw. Virginia literally came in the day before the NCAA tournament. If we remember back to the ACC tournament, they had the positive test. They had to wait to go into Indianapolis. So yeah, that's one thing that stands out. I think another thing that just stands out is just how wacky this NCAA tournament has been. It's already the lowest average seed in the Sweet 16 of all time.
Yeah.
So in other words, there have been more upsets and more lower seeded teams than any other NCAA tournament to this point. So that stands out. And then, of course, everything being in a bubble, all the games are being played in Indianapolis, some of the locations, you know, Hinkle Fieldhouse where Syracuse has played, and some of the other arenas around Indiana. So it's definitely a unique tournament. It's probably, you know, the most unique NCAA tournament we've ever had since the expansion, at least. Just in terms of the upsets and how everything's in one location and teams are being bubbled and so on and so forth.
Yeah, a little bit of an atmosphere too, which is nice. Matt, I'll throw this one at you. We'll get out of here and talk Syracuse enough. I think people are prepped for that Houston one on Saturday, but I can't let this one slide because I got to blast the NCAA when we talk. And I've gone a few digs in here yet, but what happened with the woman was really shameful. The gym and the facilities and the workout equipment that they were handed, and I forget who exactly exposed it on TikTok, I think it was, or across multiple social media platforms, but the NCAA's response, like spinning it to say like, oh, good thing we've been alerted to these
facilities and the situations that the women athletes here have to go through. Like, we can make this a positive. Mark Emmert started making all kinds of excuses for it. It was just the most sleaziest response to legitimate gripes and really just a shameful setup there. And I forget what their excuse was. Like, that was like a warm-up setup to get before you were going into the game. But whoever showed it showed too that there just wasn't the same like expansive and comprehensive gym setup for the women at this tournament as there was for the men. And my whole thing on that is, if you're going to stand behind amateurism and Title IX, and that's going to be your setup here, that we're going to create equal opportunities for everybody, and on both sides, you're going to get a college degree out of this, and it's just all amateur for no, you know, whether you're men, whether you're women, whether you're basketball, whether you're soccer, field hockey, all this stuff, you got to at least live by that minimum Title IX standard. And it's very clear that they don't. That there's two sports here that get preferential treatment over all the others. And even women's basketball, which has gotten, you know, national TV status here, has stars that appear on SportsCenter and all this stuff. It's definitely one of the top tier college sports beyond the top, behind the top two. But they just don't live up to the standard of whether it be Title IX or just general equal opportunity for athletes across the board here. And I know it's special circumstances. I know it's a bubble and all that stuff, but it really was shameful, the visual.
Yeah, for sure. The women's basketball championship, I think it was 2 years ago. There wasn't a game last year. I think 2 years ago had as many views as one of the Grand Slam finals for tennis, which is a global sport. One of the NBA finals games a couple years ago, I think game one. So there's a lot of attention, especially at this time of year. And to your point, I mean, the game is, they play well. Those women are elite athletes and deserve to be treated so with that respect. But yeah, I mean, look, Dana O'Neill actually, I think, crushed it with kind of a heater coming at the NCAA. And this, you know, this isn't to say that everyone in that organization isn't good. I mean, it very well could be 90% of the people there are kind and well-meaning, and it's just the leadership that's on a different planet. But yeah, I mean, it'd be nice to see in 2021, especially just after the pandemic and how much we've been talking about inequalities, for this to not have happened. I mean, I just, like, of all that, like, maybe 2 years ago, it's obviously way too late, but okay. But even just after the pandemic, we talk about kindness and equality, and those are such important themes, and then to just kind of flop on the biggest stage and just to write a check and send some equipment over there for the NCAA. All right, if it costs 30-40 grand to set up a weight room, I mean, that to them that's like $5 for me, you know. So I just don't understand.
And again, if you're gonna take all the billions from this tournament every year, that's the least you can do. Turn it back into opportunities, especially for the young. I mean, that's the whole argument of amateurism, that these top football, basketball programs are going to funnel down to at least a gym for the woman. So it's like, if you're not going to do that, pay the men. You're like, pay the men what they deserve and figure out other ways to compensate people down the line and just make this a more equitable situation here. Because right now it just feels like that a few power players at the top are taking all the money from this big March thing we do every single year and fiending, whether it be through commercials or sentiments and all this stuff, I trickle down toward other opportunities for other people that don't actually exist.
Well, there wasn't enough space for the women. There wasn't enough space for the workout equipment.
He just goes on an excuse tour. What was the other big one he threw out there?
I don't understand.
Amazing. No, to your point, Bobby, you know, it's a billion-dollar tournament. This is a billion-dollar sport. I don't understand why we can't get NIL rights passed sooner. I don't know why that takes so long.
Transfer? There's a big holdup over transfer now again?
Well, that's passed, and that's fine, and that's great. But I don't understand why it's treated as if it's an amateur sport, and we all know it's not amateurism. It's a billion-dollar tournament. It's a billion-dollar sport. Let these athletes go out, and at least if you're not going to pay them, at least let them go out and make money off their name, image, and likeness. I don't think that's a very hard thing to get past.
Yeah. Even the women. I mean, there are certain women basketball players who absolutely would be able to take advantage of something like that. Like, I see UConn star. I mean, she just seems so marketable, so ginormous. Brittany Griner way back when, Taya Cooper, other people who have played at this level.
Brianna Stewart couldn't have made some money at UConn. I mean,
Sue Bird, couple bucks, yeah,
for sure.
I mean, yeah, it's indisputable.
You guys saw the Buddy Boeheim, I think the donuts thing. I didn't really follow it that closely, but basically, I mean, the kid can't even give, let's just say 100% of the proceeds to charity, help the Boys and Girls Club, help the Salvation Army, help, you know, you name your favorite charity in CNY, and he can't even do that. I mean, he's not profiting a dollar from that.
It's such a joke.
That would be doing good for the community. It's what the NCAA, you know, quote unquote, says on their website, you know, student athletes and community and, you know, respect and whatever. So
yeah, a lot of this stuff's inevitable, and you want to start making some of these easy changes to make some of the hard and more difficult decisions about the sport mm-hmm. down the line. I mean, that's for another day, but this is stuff we've talked about forever. And the fact that so much of it still hasn't changed or even begun to change is so frustrating. And it really is the leadership at the highest level of the sport. And I think more power players like Jim Boeheim, like other people, are going to have to start speaking out on it. The problem is, a lot of the time, those people benefit from the power structure that's been put in place here. So they aren't always thrilled about speaking out on it and trying to get a change fast. So it's a tough situation with college sports. We love to enjoy it. We love to consume it, but there is still so much wrong with it, it appears, especially when it comes to, you know, equal opportunities up and down and equal facilities and all of that stuff. I think what is good about Syracuse is you got the women's basketball team that has the Mello facility. They play in the Carrier Dome. You wish more people would be there for those games, but they've gotten high status by having the TV deals and everything else that come with playing at Syracuse. So it's been great to see the Syracuse women get some extra attention. But, man, they got smoked by UConn. Oh, my Lord. They can't catch a break with that region.
Yeah, it's the slight. I mean, they just need to get, like, this is what, I think, three times now in the last 5 years that UConn's ended their season. I mean, obviously, what's the national championship. So, okay, you know, Syracuse did really well that year. But these two seasons, I mean, the 2017 and then 2021, to get UConn in the second game, I mean, hopefully the selection committee can do Cuse a favor, put two and two together and say, all right, maybe let's put them in different regions, maybe a Final Four matchup. But for these early exits, you know, everyone knows UConn is the team to beat, right? So hopefully Cuse, you know, Coach Cuse's team's really good. And just last thing too, from me on the women's team is Tiana's remarks on, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday night after the game. She was in tears in her last press conference, puts it all in perspective. One of the most honest athletes I've seen, one of the most honest, candid press conferences, quite frankly, which is kind of a situation that's not designed for honesty, right? I mean, you don't really know anyone in the press conference. You got a mic, the NCAA logo is behind you. It's not really a natural thing for a lot of student athletes. And for Tiana to go out like that just speaks volumes.
Some talk of her number getting retired, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, right? You know, James Noon's Magician's written about it. Daily Orange has written about it. Brent Axe has touched on it. The importance of just getting these women's jerseys retired, and, you know, Wildhack seems to be, you know, getting on it. So that's good. Hopefully we're in the right direction.
Yeah, I think
there's a committee in place now. I don't think it should be that hard to get some women's basketball jerseys retired.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So Syracuse, they're playing bright and early at 9:55. I do got to shout out the DO and Noon's Magician on that front, but I do have to take a dig at the DO as well for a piece I read by Anthony DeBundo today. Let me throw this up on the screen. He's had a good tournament, but, and I appreciate a writer writing with some agency here, throwing this out there, but let's see what you guys think of this. Logo Joe. Are we doing this? Logo Joe Girard. He's had a good tournament, but Logo Joe, I mean, Buddy Buckets, that's deserved. Logo Joe. Yeah,
I'm not in the Logo Joe crowd quite yet, but he has good, you know, he's a good shooter. I'm not in that range yet for sure.
Yeah, I'm not in the Logo Joe crowd either, but I am in the DeBundo's Digits crowd. I will say that.
Yes, Anthony's DeBundo's great with that. Digits.
Well done, Anthony.
For sure.
But to throw that in the end there, I got to take issue with that. I'm going to be the copy editor and just be like, All right. Appreciate you guys. Matt Gutierrez writes for The Athletic. James Zuber writes for noonsmagician.com, and we will be watching at 9:55 when Syracuse takes on Houston. 6-point underdogs, I believe, which we'll see how that goes. Feels like they can win. These guys made the case, and maybe we'll get to talk at the Final Four if things go some type of way over the next two games here. So talk to you guys soon. Always good to talk to you here on Dome Theory, and good luck with the rest of your coverage.
Appreciate you, man.